Hello, everyone, and welcome to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games. I am your slightly healthier co-host, Mark Bigney, and with me is my consistently suffering co-host, Michael Walker. How you doing, Walker?
Pretty good after the incident. Mark claims, hey, I've got this new bat, he says, behind me. So then after I fought my way off of the plague cart, here I am.
So this is being recorded on April the 1st. Both Walker and myself, we don't share a whole lot of principles outside of board games, but we do share the principle that April Fools is a blight upon the information landscape of humanity. This was true even before mis- and disinformation became vastly more pernicious in popular culture. We do not condone it. We do not endorse it. So there will be no such jokes on this episode of Silver Robot Games.
None of this would be misleading stuff.
Otherwise, it would be shenanigans, and we don't like shenanigans.
I like when things are so far left field that it should be obvious that it's a joke.
Yes.
But then, I don't like the sleight of hand stuff.
It's no good. It's bad. So we are going to talk about the game we reviewed 1 year ago, the as yet unnamed retrospective intro segment, The Eurus. Then we're going to talk about the games we played last week, the news and why it doesn't matter. And then we are going to let Walker's damaged vocal cords take a rest and we'll call it a day. So with that in mind, Walker, what did we review last year?
So exactly 1 year ago, Mark, we reviewed a game called Carnegie. And what Carnegie did was bring this new publisher out into the limelight. What they did was they put this game up on Board Game Arena.
Before it was published,
A year before it even came to Kickstarter. And then it was on Kickstarter. And then it came out. And that's not to say other publishers haven't been doing that. But the common thing has been it's available during the Kickstarter and then they remove it.
Right. And vastly more common, and you still see this all the time, is they'll make a tabletop simulator module, but a fully supported, fully implemented module on Board Game Arena is vastly less common. And I think Carnegie was definitely one of the foremost major releases to do that, I think.
And I still have my Carnegie game. I'm not planning on getting rid of it. It does lots of things that are different. You have this really interesting way to shift your workers around. Are they in the buildings? Are they out on the map? Are you making sure you're ready because people can do actions that you're not ready for? You sort of have to blanket across all the actions so you're ready for when they when they will come up, because they can even come up twice in a row. You don't know. It's this very interesting mechanism. If you haven't had a chance to try it, it's on Board Game Arena.
I do like the employee management. We've played it several times since we reviewed it, largely because it is one of your very favorite Euro games of the past few years. I'm not as enthusiastic. I don't like the way the charity scoring works. It feels a little swingy, a little unsatisfying, and a little disconnected to what the rest of the game is. But the manipulation of employees and the manipulation of the timing of actions in Carnegie is pretty enjoyable. And so I'll happily play it if suggested, but it's not one of my all-time favorites. And that is Carnegie or any number of other pronunciations by Xavier Georges at Quinid Games, published in 2022.
All right, next up is games we played last week. Mark, what did you get to play last week?
I played another game of Legacy of You. I talked about this last time. This is me playing Legacy of You. I don't know why you find this so complicated. And this is a sort of pseudo campaign, but really it's a series of loosely linked scenarios. Solo game by Shem Phillips at Garp Hill Games. And the fundamental resource challenge is rather neat. You've got these barbarians flooding in. Dealing with them is very expensive. They get somewhat less expensive as time goes on. They just keep creeping forward and forward, but then you might get overwhelmed, and so you're walking that tightrope. At the same time, you're trying to make sure that you have enough resources to build the canals, which is nominally the victory condition. I say nominally because I haven't really seen what those victory conditions look like yet. I'm still struggling with the flood of barbarians. This time I lost, and it was entirely my own fault. I get a little greedy because I figured, I have enough to build two levels of the canal this round. Great. Not realizing that I had to survive to the end of the round and then the barbarians done got me. Had I spent a little bit more time thinking about it, I probably would have been able to pull it out. But as it was,
you could see the picture, right? You're standing there, you're admiring your canals.
Oh, yeah.
And the guy beside you say, that's a really great job. And you look over and you say, who are you? Oh, no.
What a splendid canal you've done built for me. Yes, precisely that. Now, I actually was very curious, independently, but also especially because a listener chimed in on the Patreon to say, look, my problem with The Legacy of You was that I found that the replayability was really problematic. And I could easily believe that, because here's the thing. It's very short, and it's got a compelling resource management puzzle. But the problem is, it's not really something with too much of an arc. There's not a whole lot of room to breathe or experiment or maneuver. And consequently, when you have some of these shorter games, they can feel a lot more repetitive. And I'm already starting to see bits of that. The narrative elements, there are some narrative elements, but they're very, very light. It's like, dude thinks of building canal, thinks building canal is hard, regrets barbarians come take stuff. Like, I'm not trying to, the writing isn't that stilted, but it's just in terms of the event, there's not really much scope or personality to what's going on. And it just, the fundamental structure does not change from game to game. The elements that are being introduced are really negligible. And it's one of those games where the core system itself doesn't lead to a whole lot of variety. So, for example, there's this stack of villager cards. At the start of the game, you start with 10 of these villager cards in your deck. And you figure, oh, lots of variety there. Well, not really, because the villager card, you discard it for a clay or you discard it for a wood. And so...
Gotcha. So there's no scenarios that you play. The variability comes with the way the cards are shuffled from game to game.
And every time you lose or win a game, some new cards enter the system as a consequence. Gotcha. By enter the system, I mean they enter the pool of available things. They won't necessarily show up. And so it feels a little scattershot, a little all over the place in terms of the fundamental variability. Now, I have not yet soured on the fundamental resource challenge yet. I think part of that may be driven by the fact that I've lost twice and I haven't won. I'm getting closer, though. I'm getting there. The difficulty rubber banding didn't really kick in. The stuff that was introduced as a consequence of my first loss did not show up in my second game at all. So I wasn't given a leg up from there. So we'll see what happens in my third game. And we'll see if I get soured on the fundamental challenge. As I say, I focus on how all these structural elements do not vary things. Mostly to emphasize the fact that it's still getting by on the core engine. We'll see how long that lasts, though. So that is my further experience with Legacy of You, designed by Shem Phillips, published by Garphill Games last year.
So, Mark, I sort of played a new solo game of Set a Watch, and I'm only talking about it because me setting up a solo game is saying something that I wanted to play it. I picked up my own copy with the expansion. And what Set a Watch is that you always play with four characters. You have to go through 9 different sort of battles. And every time you do a battle, a hero has to stay behind to tend the fire. So in this, with the expansion that I got, add sort of a merchant. So it mostly deals with that person that's staying behind. They get a bunch of money on their board. And every time they take those actions, they get the money. And then you put money on all the actions they didn't take. And then you use that money to buy these new items. Why it was sort of a game was because I think it was the second fight, I came up against this boss monster early in the line. So you have this big line of creatures, and every so often you'll get a portal card that says bring in a big boss. And unfortunately, this was right near the beginning of the line. And this card says move them to the back. And every time you kill one of the creatures that are in the line, all your dice go down by one. And the dice is what you use to do everything.
Mm.
So seeing as I still had practically my full line and he was at the back, and the one character that could take care of creatures that are further back in the line, because normally you can only deal with the first two, was unfortunately back at the fire.
Ooh.
That was a quick end to that game. And so that was my Set a Watch. I'm still looking forward to playing more. I like games that are very puzzly like this and hard and not so easy every time. Set a Watch is designed by Mike Grund and Todd Walsh and put out by Rock Manor Games.
Well, hard, solo, and puzzly are certainly three words that I would use to describe Gloomhaven Buttons and Bugs. This is a review copy we got from the publisher, and I am now slightly deeper into the campaign, and I can definitely attest that the early scenarios, they didn't feel like tutorials, but they were tutorials. And frankly, that is the way I like things to be done. I am perfectly willing to accept a difficulty spike later on in the campaign, so long as A, I'm engaging with the full game, and B, they don't feel like trivial raffle stomps. And one of the joys of the fundamental Gloomhaven card structure is that you are still manipulating all these cool abilities. And so you don't feel like your hand is being held, even when your hand is being held. And let me tell you, right now I'm at the point where my hand is not being held anymore. Now, this is both good and bad. I appreciated the challenge. And I enjoyed getting my face stomped in. I'm just funny that way. But I feel that this particular challenge, the way this scenario worked, wasn't playing to Buttons and Bugs' strength. Now, in base Gloomhaven, what you have is you have a very, very tiny AI deck for every monster type. And one of the cards shuffles the deck prematurely. But broadly speaking, there are 8 cards. And so when an ability shows up, you're pretty guaranteed that that ability is not going to show up again for some time. Worst case scenario, it's on the reshuffle card, in which case, in theory, you could have that ability show up over and over again. But there's a certain amount of control. In Buttons and Bugs, there's roughly a 1 in 3 chance of 3 different AI profiles triggering at any given time. And in this particular one, the boss is heavily armored, and a third of the time, it does nothing but heal. This is not great. And so some of the techniques that one can use, a lot of my dormant Gloomhaven knowledge came back to the fore. Like, one of the things you do against heavily armored creatures is you give them the wound status effect. The wound status effect says they take 1 damage every time they activate right off the top. Another thing you can do is retaliate. Retaliate also does damage that bypasses armor. There's a bunch of tools that you can use. The problem is that my character has some retaliate, but not at range. Okay, well, the boss was ranged, wouldn't work. Okay, fine. But then the wound status goes away whenever someone heals. And so here I am wounding the boss over and over, trying to bypass armor as best I can, not having much success there. And all of this goes away if the boss just heals twice in a row, which is exactly what happened. And this is basically a good news, bad news situation for Gloomhaven, Buttons, and Bugs. The fact that I was engaging in a lot of these same techniques, these same tricks, these same tools, using items and skills and the map all together to make sure that I could inflict these statuses and bypass these defenses, is a legitimate triumph for a game of this small package, small setup time, small playtime. I really enjoyed that aspect. It was substantially undercut by the fact that the boss could just randomly trigger these things. And consequently, I am reasonably confident, I've sort of reconstructed it back through at the end of the scenario, I would have won easily if the boss had just triggered any other AI profiles than the 2 in question. Basically bringing it back to full and undoing all my efforts. Because that leads to the other thing about Gloomhaven, which your comments about Set a Watch really highlight. Gloomhaven, Buttons and Bugs feels puzzly in a way that Gloomhaven doesn't. You know, I use the term tactical puzzle in a sort of broad sense, but it doesn't feel like a puzzle in the same way that an actual, you know, puzzle feels. And the analogy I will draw is as follows. I don't know, Walker, did you play any of the solo scenarios for Gloomhaven?
I did not.
They were brutally hard, and they tended to have, you know, a narrow kind of lane for their solutions. When playing normal Gloomhaven, there's a certain amount of improvisation that you can do. There's a certain amount of reaction to what your colleagues are doing. It's a sort of evolving tactical situation in which you can have some degree of flexibility and try out new things to a certain extent, even in the harder scenarios. The solo scenarios for Gloomhaven and all of the scenarios for Buttons and Bugs seem very much, here is the path you must tread. And if you deviate, and a new wrinkle in Buttons and Bugs, if your luck happens to be reasonably bad, well then, you're out of luck. And all told, that's a bit of a sour note, but it is only a minor downside and otherwise something that I think is a really interesting design and physical package. I'm a big fan of Buttons and Bugs, even though a lot of those elements, the puzzly nature, the randomness of the AI attitudes, is not what I really appreciated about some of the elements of Dungeon Crawls. And one of the things that I appreciated that Gloomhaven, core Gloomhaven, largely does away with much of the time. So
what do they do with the characters? I'm just wondering, like, with Set of Watch, you have to play the 4. What do they do?
It's a solo game. You play one hero. That's it.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. Yes. Nice. Yeah. It's built around that. And consequently, it's not really much of a surprise that it feels a lot like the Gloomhaven solo scenarios. So if you're like me and you played the Gloomhaven solo scenarios, and say, oh, that's kind of interesting, then Buttons and Bugs may well be for you, because I prefer Buttons and Bugs to the Gloomhaven solo scenarios, but they have the same kind of feel. If you loved the solo scenarios, oh my goodness, Buttons and Bugs is going to be your jam, I think. But as I say, I am still delighted by the design innovations. I'm delighted by the tiny package, the quick playtime. I'm more than happy. Just 20 minutes between tasks. Shove my keyboard back a couple of inches and just play out a scenario on my desk. It's that small. It's that portable. That is Gloomhaven, Buttons and Bugs by Joel Klipfel, the designer of Gloomholden, the inspiration for Buttons and Bugs, and Nikki Valens, published by Cephalofair Games this year.
Mark, we streamed this Saturday, or I streamed this Saturday. Played a couple of games. The first one was a new game that just came out, Stone Spine Architects. Not of the West Kingdom. Not of the East Desert Lands. Just Stone Spine Architects. This is designed by Jordi Aden and put up by Thunderworks Games. And I really enjoyed it. What you're doing is you're building your dungeon. But it's much like a roll and write. You're doing it to satisfy these goals. You're drafting cards, but then the one thing I like is the fact that now it's the purchase phase, and either you can bypass purchasing anything in order to take a gold card right away, because before anyone else says, you're going to get a gold card by the end anyway. But if there's a particular one you want, then you're going to like pass. I pass on that, and I take the gold card, because you get it when you pass. And it has a little bit of fairy tale feel, because you have all these different scoring conditions and you're passing around the cards, drafting, and you're building your dungeon. It's like, okay, are the main goal of this particular game was have the most gnolls. So you're trying to get gnoll cards out. Maybe.
I like it already.
There you go. And
you had a gnoll goal?
A gnoll goal. And so you're building this big grid, and it'll say have a certain amount of traps on a path, or have a block of stone versus dirt dungeon, or have slimes versus oozes, or tons of these different goals, and you're putting out these cards.
Can you have an orc board?
You can have an orc board.
You have a null goal for your orc board?
Yes, just so.
You may be breaking me, Walker.
Well, it is very interesting. So you build four rows, so the game only lasts four rounds. It plays very quickly. The goals are straightforward. For the first three rounds, like I said, you're going to be passing to get a gold card at the end of the purchase phase. And then there's that main gold card for the whole game. And the purchase phase allows you to sort of spice up your dungeon. In a way, right? Because some of the cards that you play might not have what you want, or you want more.
This dungeon corner has coriander.
That's right. You might want more of what you need. So the purchases are on these cards. And it's either you're putting more gnolls in, or more orcs, or a trap, or a secret door to because there's paths on your dungeons. You want them to link up, so there'll be a secret door. You can place that. That will now link up the two cards that weren't linked in the first place. Very much enjoyed Stone Spine Architects. Would play it anytime. After we played that, we played Marshmallow Test. This is a trick-taking game by Reiner Knizia, put out by Game Right. Most likely could be my favorite trick-taking game.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
High praise.
Really love it.
It is really good.
It has five different suits, numbers 1 through 12. And depending on player count, we played with four. So the moment you win three tricks, you're out of that round. And you're going to score points equal to the number of tricks the other players have won to that point.
But Walker, that just makes it sound trivial. I just want to go out last, right?
No, Mark. Because if you go out last, you get no points.
Oh, no!
So it leads to this crazy, last round where everyone just needs one trick, or there's two people left. So my strategy usually is win up to the last trick right away.
Yep.
And then maybe just hold on, maybe have that.
It's the obvious thing to do. I know it's obvious because it's what I try to do. And then I find that that last trick becomes impossible because everyone's looking around. It's no thing. Everyone's happy to let you win those first two tricks because that's points for them. And then that last trick becomes impossible.
Yeah, and it has the sort of trump breaking the glass sort of mechanic. Where the first round of the game, there's no trump. But then whoever was last in the first round gets to pick trump for the next round. So they just look at their hand, they pick the trump, they also get to lead. And how trump works is if you can't follow suit, you can play a trump if you wish. You can play another card to throw it away. But you could play trump. But as soon as someone does play trump, no one else has to follow suit anymore. They can now play trump cards. They can't throw away. But they can play trump cards or follow suit, which leads to all sorts of shenanigans as well. Love Marshmallow Test. Would play anytime. Reiner Knizia, Game Right.
So let us begin with a brief tale of failure.
Oh.
I realize I've mostly been talking about solo games that I've lost. I don't consider that to be a failure, though, because I had a good time. So Black Rose Wars Rebirth. This recently got fulfilled, at least in my neck of the woods. This is the sort of standalone pseudo-sequel to Black Rose Wars, which is one of our favorite silly bash-each-other-across-the-face games. And set up the game, non-trivial setup. Did the rules explanation again, non-trivial rules explanation. Here we are with all these toys. We're starting to internalize a lot of these keywords. And Huey does the obvious thing, right? He does a very, very obvious thing. He turns himself into a bear. If given yourself the opportunity, you choose bear. This is one of the rock solid principles of this podcast.
I'd recommend it.
Yeah, yeah. So would I. And it's like, all right, where is card for bear? Like, he cannot find card for Bear. I'm like, okay, I know there's a miniature for Bear. I go looking for miniature for Bear because the first thing I did when I got this project fulfilled was, well, first of all, I had it sit in the box for a while. But then I spent the necessary hour sorting everything because there's a non-trivial amount of stretch goals and expansion content and different boxes and tearing it apart. I know I've got them. I know I have these things, Walker. I know I have Bear. Don't know where I put Bear. It's not in the box. It's not with the other summons. So then Huey says, okay, well, let's just swap out that School of Magic.
Yeah, we're not too far in.
We're not too far in. It was just the start of the first turn. Okay, get rid of Bear. We replace Bear with something else. Then, midway through the first part of the new game, Huey summons something. Sure enough, not there. I'm sorry, Walker.
It's all right.
Like you said,
there are so many parts. This is like, what, Kickstarter number 3?
But it's small. It's there. I was so pleased because it all fits in one box. You can't do that with the first Black Rose Wars with a standard Kickstarter pledge. It was comparatively more sane and more restrained. I say comparatively because I wouldn't want to say that it was sane or restrained, but it was comparatively more limited. And so, well, what it did for me was it reignited my enthusiasm for the prospect. And so now I'm just left frustrated. So now I'm just going to have to make sure that I get all that stuff and sort it properly. I have a pretty good idea where it is because there's all the stuff that related to Avatar mode and other game modes that I didn't want to mess with. I think Bear is there. I think I stuck Bear in the optional stuff when really Bear is not optional.
No.
Core Bear. So that's not really a playing of Black Rose Wars Rebirth.
Mark, I'm happy to say that I got Almost Innocent back to the table. This is designed by Filippi Attali and put out by Colossal Games. And what it is sort of it brings back fond memories of Incognito. There are 4 decks and they all have a certain number of cards. And if you have that card, then you know, that other person doesn't have it. It's this type of thing where you get one victim, one weapon, one potion in one place, I guess, let's say. And those go to another player.
Colonel Mustard with the candlestick in the library. Yes.
Those are your cards, but they have it. You can't see them. And that goes all the way around the table. So everyone to your left has your cards, say. And then you start asking questions. And I always usually tell the players that when you first start to ask the questions, you have no information of what you need. But you do have Joe's cards, say. And so you look over and you say, look at the board because it has this grid of all of the things. And that's how you sort of lock down what people have. Is like, well, Joe's got 3 things in that row, so I'm gonna ask Jimmy over there how many things that I have in that row, even though I have no idea how my things are, but I know Joe has 3, and once it gets around to him, because when I ask a question, it goes all the way around the table, everyone gets to ask the same question. So when it gets to Joe, that's gonna give him a lot of information. So you ask questions about other people's cards, because that's what you have the information for. And then mid-game, when you actually need to know certain things about your board, then you start asking particular questions that you need to know. And it has a very silly story that goes through all the different scenarios. It has interesting things. It's hard to explain that because, like I said, it has the grid of all the cards.
Right. Well, all the suspects and all the details are put out in some sort of weird grid, but not all the cells of the grid are the same shape or size. And so you have these weird rectangles that stretch across. And so you start getting weird answers, and you're like, okay, well, that could mean one of several different things based on how this works.
Yep, and so you have 2 different kinds of questions. You can say, how many of my clues are in this row, or is my particular clue in this row? And you only have a certain number of each of those questions, and once you've asked them all, then you now have to make your guesses. And if you get right or wrong, it's a great game. Everyone seems to enjoy it so far, except people that don't know their left from right. But
It is legit confusing.
It is 100%.
I make a lot of noise that it's just play passes clockwise and counterclockwise at the same time, and it just breaks my head wide open. And it also leads to further confusion because it's the kind you have to be very, very careful because one wrong answer literally ruins the game.
Yep. So the answers go around the table, and so you might be confused as to where you left off, and then you go left to right. I can see where it can make. But the art, so charming. And it just goes into the story, makes it that much more silly. It's like, okay, you're at this bar, you got fed too much spiced wine, and you wake up.
I think it was spicy tea, actually.
Spicy tea, yeah. And all of these people are missing, and everyone's looking at you because these people are missing, and it says, okay, well, you go looking for them, and the sly mouse helps you out. And then the next scenario as well, you've run into this angry guard who was, like, knocked out at the same time, and he thinks your story is wishy-washy, so he calls down the captain, and that's scenario three. Now you have to go through the whole story again with the captain. That's, you know, that, you know, you telling all the facts of the story. Anyway, very charming.
The artist is Satoshi Matsuura. It's the same artist that did Hidden Leaders, and every picture he does, granted a lot of it's anthropomorphic animals, whatever, not all of it, though, is dripping with personality, and each... It's one of those games where, much like Hidden Leaders, every character portrait seems to tell a story all by itself. You want to know who that person is. What's their deal? What are they up to?
Just so. I think we're going to play it, you know, going forward. This time we played it before the stream. And I think going forward we're going to be doing that as well. It's just showing up early, playing a scenario of Almost Innocent, and trying to get through the whole sort of quotation marks campaign. And that's Almost Innocent.
Well, on the topic of cooperative deduction games, I get to play a cooperative deduction game that I actually really enjoy, specifically Paint the Roses. Paint the Roses is much more fluid and dynamic, I think, than a game like Almost Innocent. For one reason, you're cycling through different puzzles at a time, and consequently, I don't feel the need to go quite in the weeds about note-taking and note-keeping, and consequently also the game doesn't completely fall apart if somebody makes a single error. So it's far more forgiving in that sense. And it's also got a tiling element, and by virtue of that, it really adds a spatial dimension to the key aspect of many a deduction game, because Almost Innocent has this as well. Namely, why did they ask the question they asked, as opposed to asking a different question, and what can I infer from that? And that, I find, is some of the more subtle inferences in Paint the Roses that I really enjoy. Why did they place that tile there when they could have placed those other tiles in other places? Or indeed, they placed a tile this way and said that it created no matches, or it created only one match. Well, why did they pick that one, and can I make any inferences from there? The pressure is real, because in order to win in Paint the Roses, you have to start making multiple successful guesses. There are lots of rounds where you don't want to make a guess during a round, and then there are some rounds where you have to make multiple successful ones in the same round, and both of those are very challenging. But nonetheless, you have to keep up, and sometimes if you're not doing well, you have to kind of make a guess, which is sometimes when you lose. Such is the way of things.
Yeah, we have a crazy axe-wielding queen chasing you down. That's a problem.
Yes, it is loosely themed off of Alice in Wonderland, where the gardeners know that there are directions and know that they will be punished harshly for not following the directions, but sometimes they don't know what those directions are, and so that's where you get into the deduction element. The components are delightful. I've got the deluxe edition with the lovely plastic miniatures and lovely Bakelite tiles and the dual-layer board and all that business. I find Paint the Roses quite delightful. When it comes to cooperative deduction, it's the way that I like to go. And yes, there are communication restrictions, but at the same time, it's good to just muse about what you know and what you don't know, and you're still allowed to communicate with the people who are not currently taking their turn. When you're taking your turn, you're just supposed to give the communication. So it's not quite as, in a way, I don't want to use the term antisocial, but it's not quite as stifling as the atmosphere of something like Hanabi, which is my other favorite cooperative deduction game. Anyway, Paint the Roses is designed by Ben Goldman, published by North Star Games. The non-deluxe version is available in some big box mass market retail situations. And I very much approve. This is another example of an excellent hobby game finding its way into the mainstream.
But are the tiles cardboard?
Yes, Walker.
Gross.
I would still be willing to paint the roses with cardboard exactly the same way that I would be willing to play Hanabi with the cards. But in both cases, much like Bear, if Bakelite is an option, go Bakelite.
Just so. Mark, I got to play this other game called Fromage, designed by Matthew O'Malley and Ben Rosette, published by Road to Infamy Games.
Oh my goodness.
I know, right? This is another one that's hard to explain. But close your eyes and picture this. There is a flat circle on the table, and you cut it into four sections. And each of these sections you divide into two spots. And in these spots you put arrows pointing north, east, and west, not towards you. And all of these arrows are worker placement spots. So you'll put up to two workers on these spots, and then the whole board, and you can only put on the pie piece that's facing you. So you put your workers on, and then that pie piece now turns. And so now, because none of the arrows were facing you then, when you turn it, some of them now are. So those workers, if you happen to put them on those arrows, you will get back. And if you didn't, then you're not going to get them until it turns almost all the way around. So it's this timing thing. It's like, and of course, those arrows that, you know, take three turns to come back are more powerful.
Right.
So it's this weird timing. Not only that, the workers are different because they're actually different kinds of cheese. And so if you
Your workers are cheese?
Yes.
Oh my goodness. Are cheese. Why didn't you lead with that?
Your workers are cheese.
That is astounding.
And so the two different spots are usually like the actual actions you're doing. And then the other section are like getting resources. So you're getting some resources and you're doing the actions. And a lot of them, unfortunately, the part I don't like about it is that the actual actions and what you're doing for the whole game is just sort of, I have the most of this here or I've done this here. And so I'm really hoping this game plays in 60 minutes or less because that kind of like the end goals aren't that exciting. So I'm just hoping that the playing and how the mechanism work is the interesting part and you get it done in 60 minutes.
Because you played this on Board Game Arena, yes?
I played on Board Game Arena. The Kickstarter's coming soon. I really did enjoy it. Either way, I enjoyed it. You're building these buildings that give you, you also have a player board that you have end game goals, but you have to build the buildings above them in order to trigger them. And one of the resource centers that you have to put workers in is put little cubes on these buildings and then they engage and then you score those extra points. It's usually just modifying the already points that you're getting, as in get a few more if you do this. And then there's like special cheese cards that you're getting as well, order cards, which are very interesting as well. It's like make this kind of cheese with this kind of thing. And it's neat because, like I said, the workers are cheese. I think it's like a soft cheese, a blue cheese, and a Swiss cheese type thing. And then depending on where they can only go in certain spots as well. So you sort of, so if I have this goal card that needs soft cheese, I got to make sure that I have, it's coming back to me when I need it to go on that space that I want it to. So it's this very interesting.
Otherwise it's going to get runny.
Exactly. Timing system. Anyway, fromage, we're going to be talking about it more because I have one coming, fromage.
I'm very eager to try this now.
Yeah, it's this giant disc. It turns. Yeah, it's going to be. Because
the giant wheel a cheese wheel?
Oh, that problem.
I mean, that seems obvious.
That'd be a big missed opportunity if it's not. Anyway, the way, unfortunately, that at least the table set up here is, you know, there's two on either side. This game will ideally work if it's a square table with a person on either side, just because of the way the wheel works. So more likely you're going to have to put your player board on on a end of the thing. And when it turns towards your player board, and they did it in a cool way too. There's like a little pylon that comes up from your cheese and it has a number on it. And so it won't be facing you until it's at the right thing. So if it's facing you, then that it, you know, doubles down on whether or not you can take it. And like I said, I did say it's arrows, but they're actually little cheese wedges. So it's sort of already built in arrow. So it's like when the wedge faces you.
Nice.
Nice. And that is fromage.
I played a game called Dragon Bond Lords of Vala. Now, Walker, I've got a bit of a problem. This is one of those, the spirit is willing but the flesh is weak kind of situations. Although in this case, it's more the spirit is weak and the spirit is more weak. I know that Troops on a Map games are real hard to do well. Really, really hard to do well. There are tons of different pitfalls that you can fall into. And you really have to tread a very careful path in order to make sure that it doesn't fall into those pitfalls. And then you have to make sure that the thing is actually enjoyable on top.
Especially when you're going multiple players. Like you can say, two-player Troops on a Map game.
Much easier to do.
Easier.
Yes.
When you go above that, then big problems.
Yes. And yet I keep wanting to try them, Walker. So Dragon Bond Lords of Vala. So this was designed by Jack Caesar and Alessio Cavatore. Alessio Cavatore was a worker for Games Workshop for a number of years. He was involved saliently, I believe, in 5th edition 40K, as well as Mordheim. And so he is an old school miniatures war game designer. And indeed, one of the expansions, I'll just mention this because I find the distribution model interesting. One of the expansions turns a couple of the army's cardboard units into miniatures. And they involve a standalone miniatures war game rule system in that expansion box. So you can, I did not try. Because also, tabletop miniatures rule systems, also very difficult to make enjoyable. Lots of pitfalls to fall into there. And this expansion is called Armies of Blood and Dreams, which is definitely a vibe.
I was going to say, when was the last time you saw like a miniature tabletop multiple player game?
Yeah, it's hard to do.
Yeah. So this all leads all into the same sort of thing. Yeah.
Well, no. Because here's the thing. There's only two armies in Armies of Blood and Dreams. Because although Dragon Bond Lords of Vala has four possible players in it, two of them are dragons. And they do not have armies. They just have a giant dragon miniature. The other two are armies led by generals. And so there's asymmetry there already, and I thought that part would be particularly interesting. Less interesting is the fact that the dragons drown themselves in points laughing all the while the human generals are like, could maybe I have a point? And the dragon says, no, more points for me. In theory, that isn't a problem, because one of the core conceits of the asymmetry of Dragon Bond Lords of Vala is that the dragons can bond to one of the generals, and then you win collectively as a team. I don't think this gets you all the way, though, because you don't want to feel as the general player to be just some sort of cheerleader saying, like, go, Dargon, go, score all the points, yay.
Yeah, I'm afraid you lost me on bonds with the human. There was a Rick and Morty episode. Yeah, it's all bad.
I hear you. Anyway, moving on. And so the asymmetry I don't think was done well. And honestly, the biggest source of, I think, actual hilarity was just the way points are doled out. The way you win in Dragon Bond Lords of Vala is you scoop up victory point tokens called power that are distributed across the map. I say distributed because they're distributed by event cards that show up at random intervals.
Oh, no.
And might say something like, oh, you, Dargon, you're standing in the forest? Here, put two more victory point tokens in the forest. And then the Dargon will say, okay.
Thank you, event deck.
Thank you, event deck. Now you might say, okay, well, what if you're not just happen to be standing there? What if it's halfway across the map? Well, Dargons get to fly, human armies get to crawl, so there's that as well. But regardless, even if it did happen, the case that it was set up in a more equitable manner, you're still talking about victory conditions that are sprinkling across the map in an arbitrary order. Now, you know they're all going to happen in a certain order. You can try to pass early so that you can get the jump on the situation and hope that this is the round where you happen to be sitting or where you've positioned yourself is where the victory points come, and then laugh when they don't. Anyway, Dragon Bond Lords of Vala was mildly aesthetically engaging. The conceit was amusing. The combat was actually kind of okay in a number of ways. It had this idea of critical hits happen right away, and then you can either run away and not fire back and not suffer the rest of the hits, or you can stand and fight, in which case all the non-critical hits would apply to you as well, but you get to throw the dice in response. That part was cool, and it largely shook out in an okay way, except for the fact that it's a little too easy to retreat, so people were slippery and sliding all over across the map. Anyway, I wanted to like Dragon Bond Lords of Vala, but really, it's the standard sort of microwave hatchet job of a troops on a map game that very clearly they cared more about the world building than they did about the universe, and hats off to them, the universe is what it is. I'm not a huge fan of dragons generally, but a lot of effort was done into it, and they've got lots of product lines planned. It slices, it dices, it juliated fries, it's a dessert topping, it's an RPG setting, it's a tabletop miniatures game, it's a troops on a map board game.
Wow.
Yeah. But nobody who played had any interest in returning to Dragon Bond Lords of Vala, and so that is the end of that. Designed by Jack Caesar and Alessio Cavatore, published by Draco Studios after successful crowdfunding.
You and I got to play a review copy of City of the Living. This was given us by the publisher, Trick or Treat Studios. This is designed by Sebastian Bleasdale and Reiner Knizia. And this is a reprint of Prosperity. I've already talked about this game. I think it was even last week. I think the flow is there. You're flipping a tile. You're doing two actions. And then it's the next player's turn. And what you're doing is you're just trying to optimize your board. You're trying to get, you know, high check marks and high security. And meanwhile, still trying to keep up, you know, your victory points and your ability to move up these tracks. And there's sort of like a mid-game sort of transfer where you're transferring from getting oil to getting victory points. And I think it plays fine. It's not really a game that I would ask to play. But if there was newer players there and you're sort of like trying to bump them up to a little more advanced game, I think this is a perfect way to do that.
I'd completely forgotten that Sebastian Bleasdale was a co-designer of this. Sebastian Bleasdale is best known for his work on the Key series. And I'm a big fan of a lot of his work in that context.
Did we look, was he on Prosperity as well? Or was he?
Yes.
Just, okay.
Yes. And it's also noteworthy because Reiner Knizia does not do a whole heck of a lot of co-designs. And I haven't played this game since it was Prosperity several years ago, about 10 years ago now. And it was all right. It was about as good as I remember. It's largely just a tableau builder where you're trying to manage a whole bunch of different values across things. What struck me most about City of the Living was how very badly the retheming seems to have been done. Honestly, it was the case that, so it's a post-apocalyptic zombie theme, whatever. You're getting vehicles for your people and weapons for your people and security encampments and this, that, and the other. It is honestly the case that you would look at two tiles and say the values of this really belong on the other. Or you'd look at a comparison of tiles and say, why is the tractor given these values and the assault vehicle is given these values? I have no ability to conceptualize what it is that they're trying to drive. And consequently, the sort of vaguely generic kind of futuristic theme of prosperity where you're balancing energy needs and pollution made infinitely more sense than this zombie version.
Maybe made more sense, but was a hell of a lot more boring, I'm sure.
I don't know, man. I would rather be bored by managing pollution than aggressively confused by what is supposed to correspond to what. This is already a game, City of the Living is, where you're just hunting down icons. It's like, okay, my yellow, I need more yellow icons. Where can I get that one? It's like, oh, this corresponds to spiked bats? Okay, whatever, I guess. It's just, it's a further thumb in the eye to remind you that you're engaged in something that's basically a glorified spreadsheet. I'm perfectly willing to play glorified spreadsheets. I'd rather not be poked in the eye about it, though. I just find the retheming to be puzzling in the extreme, and that further pulls me out of the experience.
True. I somewhat agree. It's not too bad, in my opinion, because in the end, theme doesn't really matter that much in this game.
Sure. So the flame... Okay, let me just give one specific example, all right?
Yes.
Flamethrowers. So weapons, as a general rule, give you some amount of security, possibly some amount of social strife, and maybe some other things. Flamethrowers contribute not at all to security, not at all to social strife, and what they do is they increase your fuel income. I'm no combat engineer, Walker. But I think I have a rudimentary understanding about the role of fuel in the flamethrower life cycle, and I don't think that more fuel comes out of it at the other end.
All right. Let's picture it, Mark.
Okay.
We're in a post-apocalyptic world.
I'm there with you.
We have found a crate of flamethrowers.
Yeah, I see the crate. I can touch
and
the wood grain.
And we say, oh my God, this is going to be great.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to mow down zombies, tons of them.
Yep,
but they're a little bit dangerous. Right, so we're a little leery on security.
Yep.
Everything else. And then we're like, oh crap, we're going to need some fuel.
Yeah.
Everyone's going to make the effort to get the fuel for the flamethrowers because they're great and cool. So we got to access fuel coming
in. As opposed to the rest of the time where the game is whacking you upside the head for not having enough fuel, that's not enough of a driving impetus to get fuel?
No. Flamethrowers.
Got it. Thanks, Walker. Everything makes sense now.
Does it? Good.
Yeah. That is City of the Living, published in 2024 by Trick or Treat Studios, designed by Sebastian Bleasdale and Reiner Knizia, a reprint slash retheming of Prosperity.
And those are the games we played this week. Now a quick break to pay some bills.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Save big money on your outdoor project now at Menards. We have everything you need to keep your outdoor power equipment running smooth, so you can keep that lawn in tip-top shape or enjoy some time on your boat. Right now, all FVP, lawn and garden, and marine batteries are on sale through May 5th. Check out our entire selection of FVP batteries today and view our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals.
Save big money at Menards.
We're back with the news and why it doesn't matter. Mark, all of my micro macro has returned to the fold.
Oh, good.
And why is this great?
Why it's great because lending things to people is a mistake. Charity is for the weak. I'm beginning to think that Ayn Rand was right about things.
No, Mark, that's not where I was going.
Specifically about board games, not about anything else.
Because micro macro has put out a bonus box. So now you can put all four of these maps together. You don't really need to. Because I'm sure you can go from map to map and have only one out at a time. But anyway, they all join up to make one giant map anyway. And now they now have cases that span all of the maps. So these giant cases. So now that I have them all back, we can now try out these super crazy, you know, mysteries, you know, getting
can
all
we?
The different...
How much furniture are we going to have to move that's so that we can play it on the floor?
I think we only need one out at a time.
Okay.
But anyway, I'm looking forward to giving it a go. And that's Micro Macro Bonus Box. They're all back. Super happy.
Good stuff. So just a brief update about Age of Innovation. Age of Innovation, we've talked about a couple times on the show. This is more or less the fourth iteration of Terra Mystica. And one of the things that I commented on at the time is, I don't mean to be too reductive about this, I don't want to overgeneralize, but it certainly seems like heavily asymmetric games cannot survive being released into the wild and being played thousands and thousands and thousands of times without it being revealed that there are some balance changes that may need to be made. It just seems to be part and parcel of the entire experience. And when Age of Innovation was released, I was thinking, well, let's just hope that the modifications need to be minor, because the general fan consensus of the modifications that need to be made to specifically Terra Mystica and Gaia Project are considerable if you want to play, quote-unquote, in a tournament-balanced environment. Now, we have no interest in playing that environment. We are perfectly willing to play unbalanced games, certainly unbalanced to that level. Not a big deal. But nonetheless, it didn't take long. And the publisher has already made some announcements as to changes of a couple of the factions. Here's what surprised me, though. When I saw that there were going to be changes, I thought, okay, well, let's play a little game, Mark. You've played Age of Innovation three times, which is not many times at all. And what factions would you change in turn to bring them in line with each other? And I said, well, Illusionists seem pretty small, and nobody ever took Navigators because they seemed weak. I'm serious. And ding, 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 those are the factions that are being modified. Illusionists are being made slightly weaker, and Navigators are being made slightly stronger, which is weird. Seldom are my intuitions like that match the general fan consensus. Like, I look at the balance changes that the community first came up with, and then the publishers later on came up with the factions in Terra Mystica, and they are not what I would have immediately thought. Frequently, it's the case that, oh, that faction looks a little weak, and, you know, the person who's really good at the game be like, no, they are dominant, they just do this thing, and then they completely run the table. It's like, all right,
yeah,
cool.
On first play, that didn't seem, yeah.
Exactly, or at least, you know, in terms of prima facie theory crafting on the part of me, and quite frankly, what am I? I'm some yabo who is employed by Gibbons. So what do I know about board games? But this is the case where I happen to be right in terms of my initial intuition. So there you go. So suffice, this is the classic story. This happens over and over with asymmetric games or any games with special powers. Is it good that the publisher is trying to modify things? Absolutely. Is it good that now a whole bunch of people feel that their copy is somehow defective? Not awesome. Now, is this a theory? Is this a thought? Is this a sentiment that ought to be purged? Yeah, we'd be happier if we didn't think that way. But I'm sympathetic to the people that do. It makes perfect sense. You think somehow now that it's flawed. And so now people want paste-ups. They're going to be stickers, the whole thing. Anyway, Age of Innovation. Your copy is now defective.
Throw it in the garbage.
Throw it in the garbage. Trash. Set it on fire with those flamethrowers that generate fuel for you.
Just so. Mark, I think I talked about Don't Starve,
the
board game. Don't Starve was a great computer game. You're thrown on this weird culty like island and all sorts of shenanigans happens. So if you've seen it, it's this very interesting art style of two dimension. And now that I've seen the newer pictures, because Glassworks has picked it up as well, they're on these clear acrylic standees, Mark. So it
yes.
has this very interesting sort of like very much like a video game.
Sure.
Right? Like this two dimensional looking.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it looks really good. So I hope they keep with that. It seems like it's very still early days, but we'll see.
Can I confess something that is a deep lacuna in my area of interest, and both as a board gamer and as a video gamer, causes me problems?
So I'm holding up an envelope, like, putting it to my forehead. You like acrylic standees more than miniatures.
No, that's not it. I think I like them both equally, roughly speaking. The problem is I do not find crafting inherently fascinating, whereas most games seem to think that crafting is just the best.
There's definitely going to be a lot of crafting in Don't Starve.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of its thing.
So we like, I didn't say we like Alex Cutter. Alex Cutter has designed Green Team Wins. Now he's bringing out two games with Pandasaurus Games. The first one, Mark, is called Don't Skip Leg Day.
Really?
Really.
Oh, and my goodness.
And it comes in like this water bottle, you know, like that you would bring to the gym, not like a plastic recyclable.
Oh, so it's more gym themed than Letterkenny themed.
Yes.
Ooh, okay. Tell me more.
Like, no, that's
That's all you know?
That's it.
Okay.
The name is amazing, and the fact that it comes in this water bottle. And it's going to be...
Honestly, though, if it's not associated with the hockey players from Letterkenny, I fear that it might be too bro-y and too much... Well, I mean, not that the hockey players from Letterkenny are not incredibly bro-y, but that's the whole bit.
Yeah. The other game he's bringing out with Pandasaurus is called Box Top Pinball The Haunted House.
That's a lot of words.
I know. So you make this giant pinball machines with the box, and so it's like sort of like tumbling dice.
Yep.
And you're flicking these
or
dice...
Or ice cool.
As cool, Ice cool. Yeah. So we're flicking dice, and there's all these like pinball type things. Anyway, there's one
picture. I'm there.
Exactly. I knew you would be. That's why I'm talking about it. Not much to talk about. These are early days, but it looks fantastic, and it's a flicking game, so I'm in.
Sounds great. Sounds like it has solid green team energy.
Just so. All right, so I'm unfortunately, Mark, I keep getting pulled in by these cute games.
Yeah.
Even though there's like no substance, but anyway, it's called Kyoto no Niko. I think that translates roughly into no cats in Kyoto, maybe. So. So reading right from the thing.
Neko? Kyoto no Neko?
Yeah, no Neko.
Oh, so yeah, it's Cats of Kyoto.
Is it? All right.
Yeah.
So 2 to 4 players, this is reading right from the thing. 2 to 4 players will play as kittens and explore the modern days of Kyoto, Japan.
Oh my goodness.
Through a series of independent replayable scenarios. And Mark, the art is adorable. And it's just the whole premise. Oh my God. That is Kyoto no Niko. And lastly, Horrible Guild is putting out Railroad Tiles. It is by the same, it's under the same sort of guise as Railroad Inc. All the art is the same, but instead of
Railroad Inc.
So instead of rolling the dice and drawing it in, you're playing tiles like Carcassonne style. And it's exact same art, and it just looks so clean and interesting that I'm very much looking forward to giving it a try. You're placing trains on the track now instead and cars on the roads, whatever that means. We'll soon see, because you don't do that in the roll and write.
I can't remember. What are your thoughts on Railroad Inc.?
I enjoy it. I bought the app and I play it every so often.
Yeah, people like it. It seems to be one of the more successful lines of Roll and Writes, and it seems to have survived past the initial faddish point of Roll and Write games.
Agreed. It's just the cleanly, like, take a look at it. Like, you'll just like the such so clean. It's like this white background with these like very distinct tracks and roads, and I know it's probably computer generated, so the tiles are so like
that it gives perfect. You that edges. Look,
but yeah, but anyway, looking forward to giving it a try. Railroad Tiles by Horrible Guild.
Finally, Walker, this is an episode that is a multiple of 5, and so we will acknowledge these since our Patreon. We don't like to hammer on about it too much, but we're pretty proud of the bonus content that we put out. We average about 1 bonus episode every week for people who pledge $5 a month and more, and there's lots of other bonus stuff besides, including things like unedited episodes with ad-free and free games at higher levels, participation in the Discord, all over the place. Please feel free, if you're inclined, to visit patreon.com/svag, and you can see all the various bennies. And we very much appreciate your support, whatever support you're able to give us, up to and including just your time.
Agreed. And one thing I think I forget to keep mentioning when we talk about this, not only will you get all the bonus content that comes out, you also get access to all the bonus content we've made up until this point.
Yes, and there is a lot.
And there is a lot, yeah.
And there's going to be more this week. I'm going to be releasing an episode of Bloat this week, so nice. Look forward to that. And with that, that's going to do it for us this week. Thank you very, very much for your time, ladies and gentlemen. We appreciate you joining us for this episode of So Very Wrong About Games. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can find all our contact information at sowronggames.com/contact. We read everything you send us and we'll get back to you if we can. Please do take care. Take care of your hobby, and thank your rules explainer.
Peace!
You've been listening to So Very Wrong About Games, produced by Michael Walker and edited by Mark Biggin. Special thanks goes to What Does It Eat for generously allowing us to use their most excellent song, FOS, as our theme. You can find them at whatdoesiteat.com. You can reach us by email at soveryronaboutgames@gmail.com or on Twitter at sowronggames. Thanks very much, see you next time, and always, try to be right, but remember you are so very wrong.